The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El-Khoury. So today I'm joined by Dr. Irene Daria, who is a developmental psychologist specialising in teaching children how to read. And she's just launched her new book, I Didn't Believe Him. So we're going to talk to her about all things related to books and reading. Dr. Irene Daria, thank you so much for joining us on The Parents Show today.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Lydia. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So your specialization is helping children how to read. Now, I know why that's important, but can you tell our parents why it's so important to focus on this topic?
Reading and learning how to read well, it underlies all academic success, which often underlies professional success. Learning how to read is something that ideally should happen in kindergarten and first grade in the early years. And children who are taught to read well and properly, they have confidence in themselves, and that confidence carries over to later academics. Kids who cannot read well, there have been studies that have shown that all the kids know their peers' reading levels. And if a child doesn't know how to read well, the children in the classroom know it, the child feels ashamed. The child often either moves to the back of the room and is quiet so that they're not noticed, or they become a behavior problem so that the teacher focuses on the behavior instead of on the fact that the child can't read. So getting in there really early and giving a solid foundation and confidence and ability is really imperative.
And it resonates so much. I remember when my children were in nursery school, and I remember that competition of who was at what reading level, and
right,
the embarrassment for kids if they weren't at the same level of their peers. I mean, it feels like at the time that it's the most important thing in the world.
I agree.
So you have such a rich history. You've written four books. Your most recent one, I Didn't Believe Him. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Irene, please?
Sure. So I Didn't Believe Him uses my son's story as a window to how schools have failed to teach millions of children how to read. This has gotten better in Great Britain. It's getting better currently in the United States. There was a great battle called the Reading Wars over how reading should be taught. And in the year 2000 in the U.S., there were investigations done in England. There were investigations done in Canada and the United States, all in the English-speaking world. And each of those countries found that teaching phonics is imperative. And my son, when he was 5 years old, this was in 2007. This is a while ago. But the book just came out last month, and what happened to him has continued to happen to children over the course of those past 17 years. New York, which is where I practice and live, New York City, just this year is finishing phase two of getting rid of the curriculum that has been so prevalent and ineffective. And that has the umbrella term of balanced literacy. But the book reads like a novel. That's what everyone's saying. Oh my God, it's like a page turner. What's going to happen? Because what happens is my son isn't learning how to read in school. He came home, it's called I Didn't Believe Him, because at age five, he came home and told me his school was not teaching him how to read. And he was going to such a great school that I didn't believe him. I thought they were doing a great job. And he brought home great grades in reading, by the way. And he appeared to be reading, because what he had done was they were little pattern books where the sentences were repeated on each page, and he had memorized the books. So he was reading them, his body was tense, he was unhappy, he would say, I hate reading, but he seemed to be reading them. He wasn't. He had no idea how to read, and his schools and teachers didn't realize it. And as the book progresses, the tension builds, because I begin working with him. At the time, I was not a developmental psychologist. What happened that I write about and I Didn't Believe Him caused me to change careers and move from being a journalist to getting my PhD in developmental psychology and helping children learn to read. So that my goal was to get in there and prevent problems from happening, not step in later and try to fix problems. when maybe it was a little bit too late. It's never too late to fix things to some degree, but it's always better to get off to a good start in the early years. But there's a tension that happens in the book, because as I figure out, and you see me scrambling and the stress and how it is affecting my whole family and my older son and my marriage, and how Eric is having nightmares in kindergarten and not wanting to go to school, and we don't know why. And finally, he held a book behind his back. He said to me, "Mommy, you want to see how I read? I'll show you how I read." I'm giving you a very long answer. Is that okay? Very
long. That's totally fine.
Okay.
Totally.
He held the book behind his back, and turning the pages at exactly the right time, he quote unquote read the book. So it was like, a house is a home. He turned the page behind his back. A teepee is a home. He turned the page behind his back. An apartment building is a home. He turned the page. Now, imagine the thought that a six-year-old put into figuring out how to get his mother to finally listen to him. Right? That he thought of doing that.
Yeah, very clever.
Right? You know, I hadn't listened when he told me the words. And that's something I would say to parents. Really listen to your kids, because they tell you what's going on. And we often discount what they are saying. Right? So there's a tension. I begin teaching him, figuring out how to do it and doing it myself. And the school continues teaching ineffectively. They're teaching them to guess from the pictures. They did teach phonics, but in a very sporadic way, you know, hit or miss. When a silent E word came up, like cane, they would say the E at the end of the word causes the A to make its long sound. And that was it. They would move on. No child can learn a phonics rule that quickly. But the more I taught him, the better he read at home. But he didn't make progress in school, because they were using these books that had words like apartment building and dinosaur that involved guessing from the picture. So he was not progressing in reading levels. And I started saying to the school, please teach him systematic phonics. And the school started saying to me, something is wrong with your kid. So that's the tension in the book. Who's right? Right?
Yeah.
The school or me? And then something happens. I won't give away the plot, but something happens that makes me think, is there an issue? And I let the school evaluate him. And I do need to drop this plot spoiler, because it's such an important point that parents are aware of. The school evaluated him. It found nothing wrong with him. All his scores were superior or high average. And the school labeled him learning disabled because his reading level did not match his high IQ. Now, that's just crazy to happen in a school that at this point was beginning to realize its teaching methods were ineffective. And then it goes on, you know, we do have a happy ending. It talks about, you know, the happy ending, and he's went on to stellar academic success. But if I had not stepped in, and this is why I wrote the book, if I had not stepped in, what a train wreck his academic life would have been. And I really felt like we had narrowly, really narrowly escaped that train wreck. Because if my little boy hadn't figured out how to finally get through to me, I would have trusted his school blindly because it was known as being such a good school.
So, I mean, phonics is generally used here in the UK in nursery and in primary school. And is it becoming more widespread now in the US? Is it making a comeback?
Yes, yes. In the UK is ahead of the US. I know, you know, it was an issue in the UK as well years ago, but the UK switched to phonics. I'm going to answer your question, but just I want to address the UK, because that is who is listening to your show. Even though phonics is taught in school, and that's wonderful, 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 that's light years ahead of, you know, what I had to deal with. I have children come to me whose schools are teaching them phonics, who are struggling with reading because the teacher is moving too quickly for them. Through no fault of his or her own, I mean, they have to teach a classroom of children, or there may be a behavior problem in the class that's disrupting the lesson, you know. So just because phonics is, this is funny. I also wrote a series of workbooks that parents can use to teach their children how to read at home. And the first time I saw it used in a classroom, I was so excited, right?
Understandably.
Right? I'm coming in. Yeah. I'm saving the day. There's my book in the hands of the teacher. These children, you know, all will be well. and I'm sitting in the back of the classroom behind a little boy. The entire lesson, at the time, the book is now bound like a regular paperback book. At the time, it had a spiral binding. The entire time the teacher taught the lesson from the book, the boy played with the spiral binding. He didn't even open the book. And I kept saying to him, listen to what your teacher is saying. So I realized, okay, even nothing is a sure, surefire hit in a classroom. But yes, things are changing in the U.S. now. 10 states, as of last year, have literally outlawed this method of teaching called three cueing, where they guess from the picture. Phonics is making a comeback. Teachers, to their great credit, are teaching themselves. They've formed Facebook groups with names like The Science of Reading, What I Should Have Learned in College, and they're attending seminars. They're, you know, podcast after podcast is airing on reading. So many teachers are on board, and many teachers are still unaware. So,
but that's brilliant that you've shone a light on this, Irene, and that you're part of the movement to get it back in, because it you know, it still eludes me. It works. I don't know how it works, but phonics works. You know,
phonics works.
It just does. The speed at which children learn, and it's just mind blowing. It really is. And I think actually quite often you'll get it in nursery. Children as young as 3 and 4 are learning phonics here in the UK. So, but that's wonderful also that these teachers off their own bat are, you know, finding extra resources and probably like your book to motivate them and educate them into using it. It's brilliant. So, I mean, how many what challenges did you overcome to get to the point where you were listened to, that you wrote a book and that your voice was heard?
The challenge was getting the school to believe me, because they, of course, thought that they were doing things correctly. And the way I finally got them, so I was having a meeting with the assistant principal, and this is when the evaluation was pending and on the table, and I was still very much against it. And Eric, my son's name is Eric, he had been reading with me at home books that his school had sent home. So they were these repeated pattern books. And I saw him make mistakes as he read. Let's say the word was here, the first word on each page. Here, it was like a photo book of a bird, and they built the bird, you know, on each page. Here is an eye, here is a wing, here is whatever. So he thought each word was here, but the alternate page had the word the, but he read the as here. So he made the same mistakes when he was reading in school, and the assistant principal was meeting with us, and she was talking to us as if our son had some massive disability, and she was so worried about how he read, and she showed me his mistakes, and I looked at the words. I said, I can tell you exactly what his mistakes were, and she looked at me as if I was crazy, and I said, he read, because it was a similar thing, he read the as here, and she said, yes, how did you know that? I said, because it was on the previous page. He thought it was the word on the following page. And she looked through his mistakes and she realized that was indeed what was happening. And finally she said, this is fascinating. I was trained and taught that children learn to read by, you know, guessing from the picture, but what you're saying certainly matches up with his mistakes. So the school listened, and the following year did introduce phonics into the classroom, but kept the old curriculum. So it's interesting, even though, and I see this now in my work with children, even though the schools are teaching phonics, the schools are still sending home those little pattern books, which the kids still can't read, which causes them to say, I don't like reading. But other, you know, other than that, once I opened my practice, it was an immediate success because there was such a need for it. So many children were learning to read, and parents came and the children learned and they sent other families. And that's when I wrote the workbooks, because I realized I can reach only a small portion of people. But these workbooks are so much fun. They're called Steps to Reading, and they have games and worksheets and computer activities, and it's just such a pleasure. And how my wish is that more parents knew how children learn to read, because how wonderful to have it as a fun activity to do together and just send your child in even a little bit prepared right, to school or know how to support them if they need support. Because if you teach reading correctly, it's such an easy and fun thing to do with your child.
Brilliant. I mean, the parents in your school must have been so delighted you took this initiative and encouraged the school to go down that. I mean, you probably changed the kind of life trajectory of a lot of children. But I'd also one worry with what you said, that some children under the old system must be misdiagnosed. They must be, like, they tried to say that your son had a potential learning difficulty.
Many, many, many children. One of the very first review that was posted on Amazon for my book made me think, no matter what else happens with this book, and certainly I hope it reaches so many people and so many parents and teachers, because I think it's of such use. You know, it's fun to read. We're so busy. No one wants to sit down and read a book that they don't enjoy. You know, it's really written like a novel, and it's not like this heavy treatise. And you're on this journey with us, you know, and what will happen. And you see life in New York and how we live and all that stuff. And you also learn about the history of reading instruction. But the first review that was posted on Amazon of my book came from a teacher who said, "Your book has made me rethink the IEP." I don't know what it's called in the UK, but in the United States, when a child is diagnosed with a learning issue, they get something called an individualized education plan, an IEP. And she said, "Your book has made me rethink the IEPs of all the kids in my school who have one, because now I'm wondering if the issue is whether they were simply taught improperly. What more could I ask for?" Right?
Absolutely. That's such validation, and the blood, sweat and tears you put into writing a book, because it's no mean achievement. It must be so rewarding to get that. And I love the idea of the group, The Science of Reading. I mean, is it a formal group? And
it's a Facebook group called The Science of Reading: What I Should Have Learned in College. Formal group, very excellent group. People could go online and find it and join and participate. And there are many like that. If you Google Science of Reading, there are many, many Facebook groups around it.
And I think what you hit upon and what we see in your passion, Irene, is a parent's struggle to make sure that they do right by their child and make sure that their child gets the best possible education. And what would you say to parents who are out there who are listening in about that issue, about making sure you do the best for your child?
I did not want to hear this when I was the parent of young children. Being a parent is a lot of work. It's a joy and a pleasure and the most wonderful thing, one of the most wonderful things that I've done in my life. I mean, my children are my joy. But being a parent is hard, hard, hard work, especially in the early years. You are just tired most of the time. You have, you know, no time for yourself. You're doing pretty much everything for your kids. You're feeding them, you're dressing them, there's the laundry, there's, you know, everything. And I remember I was actually in school for my PhD at the time, and my professor in a developmental psychology class said the mothers in Japan teach their children how to read. And I remember that hit me so hard. My son wasn't having trouble yet. That hit me so hard because I was so tired. I thought, oh my God, thank God I don't have to do that. But now, having gone through what I've gone through, having worked with the children that I worked with and that I continue to work with, and seeing what has happened all across the world in English-speaking countries, is parents try to send your child in to school in the early years with as much of a foundation as you can give them while still taking joy in that process. I really don't want to add another job to your very full plate. And if the sound of this is about as appealing as going to the dentist, then don't do it, because it will cause more harm than good. But yeah, if it is in you, if you enjoy teaching your child, you know, I remember I would play with my boys when they were little and I would be so bored sometimes. I mean, how many times can you push a tow truck around the floor? Do you know what I mean? And yeah, I was wishing I had another activity. I wish that I had had something like my workbooks to do with them a little bit, you know, 5 or 10 minutes a day, or the websites that I, you know, have in the book. We would have played on those websites, or a little bit, you know, of math, because the early years are the foundation for everything that comes in the future, not just in terms of knowledge, meaning knowing how to read or understanding what addition is, you know, a number, having number sense, but that is when a child's self-image about himself or herself as a student is formed. And you want confidence in those years. You want your child to feel, you know, on par. And also pay attention to what the other families are doing, because I thought the families at my son's school were a little, I don't want to say nuts, because that's quite a strong word for a psychologist to use, but I would say extreme, because at my son's school, and why this maybe was so much of an issue, it was a very rigorous school academically. You had to apply to get in, and very few children were accepted. And that attracted a certain type of parent. And I was not, quote unquote, that type. I was more, you know, children need to play in the early years and the school will teach him how to read and do math. And my role as his mother is to shape him into a good human being, to let him pursue his interests, to let him play, because play is very important for young children. And that should be the bulk of what they are doing and interacting and socializing with other children. So I didn't realize how that would translate to my son. The fact that I would say 90% of the families at that school had taught their children how to read at home before they started school. Now, I thought that was ridiculous and I didn't take action. That was such a mistake, because not only my son, if he was in a quote unquote regular school with, like, you know, not such a selective academically population, there would have been more kids who were struggling. And there were kids in his class who were struggling like he was. But the others were reading really quite well. And I would do what your neighbors are doing in that case for your child. I would get him up to where his peers are yourself. Don't just think the school will do it, because your child's teacher, who I can guarantee is well-intentioned and is doing everything in his or her power to teach your child, has other children to teach. And being a teacher, a researcher who I love once said that, and he studied effective teachers, said that being a first grade teacher or a primary teacher is harder than flying the 747, because you have to do so much. You're managing a classroom of tiny little human beings and trying to impart knowledge, and the teachers really have their hands full.
Absolutely. I think there's probably any teacher parents listening in now are nodding their head away. And so it sounds like from what you're saying, Irene, is a little parental engagement goes a long way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can guarantee when my boys have children, I'm teaching my grandchildren how to read. I'm stepping in there. It'll be fun for them and for me. You know, we make it like play. It is play for them. They love it because they're learning how to read, right? It's not something that has to be a chore. But yes, parental engagement is really important.
And so can you just remind our parents? So I Didn't Believe Him is available. You've written other excellent books. And how can our listeners get your books? And what would you recommend they read?
It's available on Amazon. I recommend I Didn't Believe Him. It is on Amazon. And I also recommend my Steps to Reading workbooks, which are also available on Amazon. My website is stepstoreading.com. There's information on those books on the website and lots of free resources. There's a free video, How to Teach Your Child to Read, that walks you through the process of how to do so. So that's where I would look for information.
Fantastic. Irene, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you on the Parents Show. Thanks so much for joining and for imparting your knowledge with us.
Thank you. It was great.
So that was Dr. Irene Daria, a developmental psychologist and author of I Didn't Believe Him. So we're going to take a little break on the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. We'll be back with more chat in just a few minutes, so stay tuned.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
So welcome back to the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. It's great to have you with us again. I'm Lydia L. Curry. And tonight on the Parents Show, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Sonny Raffaelli, who is a solicitor at Raiden Solicitors. And Raiden Solicitors are, of course, the sponsors of the Parents Show, I'm delighted to say. And she's going to talk to us about the GET, or Jewish divorce. Hi, Sonny. Thanks for joining us on the Parents Show.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
So tell us about your role at Raiden Solicitors.
So I'm a solicitor at Raiden, based in our central St Albans office. I've been with Raiden's for just over a year now, and I deal mainly with divorce and separation and the financial consequences arising from a divorce. I assist with child arrangements arising from separations and divorce, and cohabitation agreements, prenuptial agreements.
It all sounds very familiar, but today I'd like to speak to you about the GET, or a Jewish divorce. Why does it have a different name to a traditional or standard divorce?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. GET is actually a Hebrew word, and it translates from Hebrew to simply mean divorce document. And Hebrew is a language that is spoken in Israel by Jewish people and non-Jewish people, and by Jewish people worldwide.
And where does the concept of the GET originate? I'm fascinated. I have to say, when I found out we were going to get to do an interview about the GET, I was like, this is so interesting. So what are the origins of it?
Yeah, so in the Jewish religion, you have a separate marriage ceremony to the civil marriage ceremony. And so naturally, there is a separate divorce process as well that goes along with it.
And is it different from a standard divorce? Does it go alongside a divorce? Is it legally binding? How does it blend with UK kind of family law?
Yeah, so it's completely separate from the civil divorce process. And the process for obtaining a Jewish divorce does differ from the process for obtaining a civil divorce in quite a few ways. So firstly, in certain Orthodox Jewish communities, a Jewish divorce can only be initiated by the husband. And this is different, of course, to a civil divorce in the UK, where it doesn't matter who initiates the divorce process and it can be done on a joint basis. And interestingly, there have been various reported instances where one party refuses to engage with the Jewish divorce process, which results in the other party being unable to remarry in Jewish law, despite having obtained the civil divorce. And in that instance, when one party is stuck and unable to remarry, in Judaism, the term is called aguna, which is a Hebrew word translating to a chained woman. And the UK courts have recently taken steps to be more sympathetic towards the wives of what we call GET refusers. So, for example, in 2019, a Jewish woman obtained a GET after bringing a case against her husband who denied this to her for almost 10 years. And the court considered this behaviour controlling and coercive behaviour, which is a form of domestic abuse. And to avoid being prosecuted, the husband eventually agreed to grant his ex the GET document, the Jewish divorce. And another way that the Jewish divorce differs from the UK civil divorce process is that the wife has to actually formally agree to the divorce proceedings in order for a GET to be obtained. And if that doesn't happen, then unfortunately a GET can't be obtained. So as I touched on before, there have been various cases where one party will refuse to engage with the divorce process, resulting in the other one being unable to marry. Contrastingly, with a civil divorce in the UK, you can still obtain that divorce even if your partner will not agree to it.
So if I understand correctly, the difference is without the GET, either side just can't remarry under Jewish law, but under British civil law, they can divorce. It's just two different processes, two different priorities.
Exactly, yes. So strictly speaking, the Jewish divorce or the get is not legally binding in the sense that the two processes for a Jewish divorce and a civil divorce are kept separate. So you can be technically divorced under Jewish law, but not divorced under the civil divorce law. So you have to obtain both as a Jewish person who wants to get divorced.
And how common is it, Sunny? How common is Jewish divorce, or how frequently are the gets enacted? Is it enacted, engaged?
Yes. So it's overall, Jewish divorces are slightly less common than various other divorces. And I think that's because in the Jewish religion, marriage is seen as a very holy institution and a combining of two souls. So a Jewish divorce is seen by some Jewish people as, and particularly the more Orthodox Jewish people, as a severance of one soul from the other. And so it is seen as very devastating in the Jewish religion for a divorce to happen. However, it's interesting because whilst it is seen in that way, Judaism still holds a core principle that if a couple are fundamentally miserable, then divorce should be the option. And it's kind of the lesser of two evils in that sense.
So it sounds like if it's inevitable, it should go ahead and it shouldn't be stopped. But where possible, every avenue should be explored before divorce is on the table as an option.
Absolutely. It's seen as kind of the last resort, which is in tandem with the civil divorce process in the UK, and particularly so after the no-fault divorce system came into place in 2022, which emphasises the fact that divorce should be seen as the last option with the various waiting periods and cooling off periods.
And is the get an international concept? Does it exist outside the UK? I'm imagining it does, because our Jewish communities are all over the world.
Yes, it does. It exists in every country. It's a universally recognised process, concept. And it is important to note, however, that if you, for example, obtain a Jewish divorce in the UK and you want it to be enforced in, let's say, Israel, you do need to take advice from a professional about that. So it will be recognised in every country, but in some countries, it would be important to take legal advice or advice from a Beth Din, which is a court in the Jewish religion, a court made up of various rabbis, Jewish rabbis.
So if you seek a divorce in the UK, it's valid in the UK. If you seek a get in the UK, it's valid in the UK, and a divorce it is. But it might not necessarily be valid in Israel. So before you even start the process, consult an expert who understands the get process in Israel.
Yes, absolutely. It's always important to seek legal advice if there are any uncertainties. But yeah, particularly when there's a question of enforcement, it's important to seek advice from the Beth Din or a professional in that country.
And so I'm trying to visualize the process. Is the process of getting a get different to that of a standard divorce? Or can you run us through the different stages and what are important things to bear in mind when you're applying for the get?
Yes, absolutely. So a get can be obtained at any point after a couple have separated. And once the application is made, and as I explained earlier, in very Orthodox Jewish communities, the application can only be instigated by the husband, but in other denominations, it can be instigated by either party. So once the application is made, a preliminary hearing will take place whereby both parties will be invited, and the husband will then authorize a Jewish scribe to physically write the get, the divorce document. And the scribe will write the get on a special piece of paper with a quill, usually whilst both parties wait. And it's important to note that two witnesses must be present to witness the procedure. And the husband will declare that he is giving the get out of his own free will, because it must be done without undue influence. And the wife will then receive the get and must state in the presence of both witnesses that she accepts the get acts of her own free will. Then when the get is given to the wife, she will physically cup her hands and the husband will then drop the get physically into her hands, and she will indicate acceptance by raising the get and then putting it under her arm and ceremoniously walking a few steps around the area. And it's interesting to note that the moment that a divorce happens in the Jewish religion is when the get is placed into the wife's hands. Until then, she is technically still married to her husband. Finally, the wife will then give the get to a rabbi who makes a physical cut in the document to indicate that it has been delivered and accepted and can't be used again by somebody else.
Wow, so it's very structured. It's very, very ritualized, really. But is that it completed? Once that ceremony is completed, the divorce is enacted and valid.
Exactly. And the physical divorce document is then put into the files of the Beth Din, and each party will then receive a document certifying that the get has been obtained. As you said, yes, it's quite a rigid process, and there are very strict rules and procedures surrounding each step. So it's very important that it's done in the correct way by a certified Beth Din.
Yeah, and it sounds like there's a lot of attention to detail and that needs to be respected.
Absolutely, yes.
So when we think of divorce, we think of financial issues, we think about children. I haven't heard anything in the get about those issues. Are they sorted out before the get, or are they sorted out in the civil ceremony under British law?
Yes, so that's treated as a separate issue. So the finances and child arrangements, as in a civil divorce case, is treated separately. So the get is literally just the divorce and just deals with that, not the finances or anything else arising from the divorce.
And when are those issues? Because obviously they're very sensitive. Finance and more importantly, the children are the crucial sensitive points in any divorce. So what point are they dealt with?
That would be in a similar manner to how they're dealt with in the civil divorce process.
Okay. Yeah. And what sensitivities, if we have parents listening in who are from the Jewish community and they want to know, you know, how their culture and their traditions would be taken into consideration, what would you say to them to help them understand how sensitively you take this?
I would say the first step should be to contact the party's local Beth Din and speak to them and get advice from them as to how to conduct the process in a manner that's in accordance with that person's culture, traditions, values. Because in Judaism, there are various different denominations, Orthodox, Reform, Masorti, and naturally each denomination is slightly different to the other with different rules and principles. So yes, I think it's important as a first step for someone to contact their local Beth Din or rabbi to obtain that initial guidance and advice about the process.
And are you, as a solicitor and you're specialised on the get, do you quite often liaise with the Beth Din?
Yes.
As well? So you're really working on almost like two cases at the same time, I suppose, or two parallel cases.
Yes, absolutely. There can be a lot of communications between the Beth Din and us as solicitors to ensure that both processes are done smoothly and that nothing happens in either procedure that's adverse to the other.
So that they just run nice and smoothly alongside each other and they're mutually supportive to each other. It makes a lot of sense.
Exactly, yes.
It sounds like a much calmer, a much less fraught process, the way you've described the process of the get.
Yes, it can be, although I think a lot more attention to the detail is required because, as I touched on earlier, each step of the procedure requires it to be done in the correct way. And so it can be less emotionally complicated, but technically speaking, it's a lot more, it can be a lot more difficult.
Yeah, I understand. You painted a very clear picture of it. So if there's anybody listening in from the Jewish community and maybe they didn't even know this service existed, where you can get support on both avenues of divorce. What tips would you give them to starting the process if they've realized their marriage has really come to an end and they're miserable? It just, there is no other avenue. What tips would you give them?
Yeah, so I would say in the first instance to speak to their local Beth Din or rabbi to get that initial advice about starting the process, and then almost simultaneously to speak to a legal professional, a solicitor, about the civil divorce process and how to ensure that both processes are done smoothly, and so nothing done in either process negatively impacts the divorce on both sides.
And is it possible to have an initial conversation with you to figure out how to proceed with it, just to for reassurance, to understand how the process works fully?
Yes, definitely. So what we could offer is an initial fixed fee meeting where we would sit down and discuss all the questions that a person would have on the Jewish divorce and or the civil divorce process. And what would normally happen is we would ask you to fill in a form with very detailed questions to ensure that the fixed fee meeting is utilized as best as possible for you, so that the time spent in the meeting is spent specifically tailored to your case, and we would understand your situation before the meeting so that we come in fully prepared and we can use the time in the best way possible for you.
Fantastic. Sunny, thank you so much. It's been really, really interesting finding out about the GET. And I'm sure if any of our Jewish listeners are listening in and they find themselves in this situation, it will be very reassuring that services are out there to support them in the way that Raiden's is.
I certainly hope so. Thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure.
So kids and parents all love a good pantomime. And this year, Cinderella comes to the Auburn Arena. Daniel Berry met with Damien Patton, Oliver Scott, Samantha Womack and George Shelley, who play Dandini, Buttons, Cinderella and the Prince respectively. He began by asking Damien about his return to St Albans.
Well, I was here 2 years ago. I did Jack and the Beanstalk and it was fantastic. And Paul, our producer, he sent me an email, said, would you like to return to St Albans? And it was an immediate yes, just to be back in the theatre, and it's great for Christmas. You know, the town, they really, you know, brighten things up. And yeah, I think I'll have a great second year here.
And Oliver, you're no stranger to panto either, because you've acted and directed in theatre. How does doing panto compare to, say, doing a musical?
Oh, panto's my favourite throughout the whole year, because it's just extra special. And I think it's extra special for the cast as well, because we get to know each other really, really well. We're doing two shows a day, every day, so we become very like a close-knit family over Christmas. And the audiences are just so up for it. They love their panto, and they love their panto here in St Albans. They come with the laughter bones, and they come with their just the joy to see a fairy tale at Christmas. So it is extra special. It's my favourite gig of the year, and to be in St Albans, I'm so excited. It's actually my 10th panto year this year, so I'm excited to be playing the role of Buttons, which I think is my favourite role of them all.
So you're both in Cinderella together, so tell us about who you're playing and what role you have to do in the show.
Well, I'm playing Dandini, and that is like the prince's butler sidekick, and that is a role I actually played last year for this company down in Yeovil. It's a fantastic part. I can't wait for audiences to see it. The whole show's uplifting, and we get to play comedy parts, which is what I do, certainly, every year. So it's really good to get your teeth sunk into kind of, you know, a part and a show that everyone will know, like Cinderella.
Yeah, and this Cinderella especially is very funny, because the sisters are funny, Dandini's funny, Buttons will try to be funny, I will try my very best. But you've got some other great characters like the fairy godmother as well, and the joy of Cinderella trying to meet her prince, and, you know, Buttons, I'm in love with Cinderella, and that's a beautiful moment. I think it's one of the most beautiful moments in panto. So I think Cinderella is extra special as well, because there's so many fun characters in it. It's the one, isn't it, Cinderella?
It's my absolute favourite. And I love coming back to see different shows year after year. So with that in mind, what would you say are the challenges that come into performing a panto?
consistency, because we are doing two every day, three on a Saturday, so it's making sure that we keep ourselves fit and we keep the energy going all the way through, because every show is important to our audience. So yeah, it's just lots of biscuits, lots of cups of tea, and lots of Red Bull, and lots of Haribo for me, you know, and other sweets are available.
That's the thing, it's just keeping the energy up. Sometimes you have a 10 a.m. show with a bunch of school kids and you've got to be, you know, top of your game like every show, just to keep the energy flowing so the audience don't mind or know that it's a 10 o'clock show or a 7 o'clock show. It's just consistency. It's quite easy for me to be high energy because, I mean, I'll wake up and bounce out of bed. So the panto is right on my
sleep. Sleep on a trampoline?
Well, exactly. But no, that's, I mean, it can be challenging depending on, you know, times of the day and all that. But I think we've got it cracked now, haven't we?
One of my favourites, and some people will say, oh, is the Boxing Day matinee, because it's everyone's gone off. We become like a family. Everyone goes off all around different parts of the UK and spend Christmas Day with their family, and then they come back, and then the audience are like, come on, entertain me. And I quite like that as a challenge. I really enjoy that.
I suppose it is quite nice because they've already had that sort of Christmassy feel, and you're still kind of in that sort of void between Christmas and New Year when there's nothing to do. So why not come to a panto and have a bit of fun?
Exactly.
Yeah. Parents, grandparents, kids. I think what's great about it is that it appeals to all audiences, not just a certain demographic.
Or if you're 2 or 102, there will be something in it for you. I mean, there's the jokes, the song sheets, the, you know, you'll find characters running in the audience. They'll if you don't think you like panto, I mean, come and see this one, because this will have something in it to make you laugh, or we'll try our best.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of panto. It is for everyone, and you get, and it becomes a tradition. People sit in the same seats on the same day, and they come with the same people, and I think that we have a real big responsibility to make sure that our panto is going to be our audience's Christmas highlight.
The best we can make it.
And comedy is a very subjective thing. What makes good comedy routines? Is it the material? Is it the actor's portrayal? Is it the script?
Oh, it's definitely Paul Hendy's script, isn't it?
Never lets us down.
Yeah, I think it's the script. I think it's our personalities, because I just play a heightened version of myself. and it's just having the freedom to have fun on stage as well, I think, to live in the moment.
If the actors, if they're having fun on stage, then the audience will be having fun. I mean, there's nothing better than seeing a routine. You know, they're not just going through the paces or saying the lines. They're having fun on stage. As long as you're having fun, we're having fun, everyone's going to have fun in this one.
And I suppose a lot of things could potentially go wrong. Is there anything that happened to you on stage that has potentially not gone to plan, and how did you overcome it?
Last time I did Cinderella, it was 2 years ago in Dunstable. I played Dandini, and I went to get the slipper, and the slipper fell through the gap in the stairs on the steel deck at the top of the stage. So the slipper was actually at the bottom of the stage, and I was supposed to come back downstairs with the slipper. So I just said, I came back down. The prince looked at me, and I just said, the girl ran away, but she left her slipper. It's over there. Because you had 1 second and 800 people looking at you going, and I was like, Oliver, get out of that one.
It's a good creative challenge, isn't it? Just getting through something. I've broken my toe mid-performance. I've had to run off stage and grab something. I ran off stage right into one of these big metal wings. Broke my toe, I found out at the end.
Left
toe, I think.
Right toe.
But I came back on, you know, you just roll with it. I mean, I wasn't hopping on or, you know, crying on stage, anything like that. When you're off in the wings, you can deal with it. But it's kind of the adrenaline gets you through. And even if something goes wrong, you'll find a way out of it. Otherwise, you just stood there with egg on your face. So best just keep going.
Well, I'm hoping we can keep the accidents and mistakes down to a minimum.
I agree.
Good luck to you both.
The audience never know.
They never know.
Good luck to you both. It's been lovely to meet you and to chat to you today. And yeah, just good luck with the show.
Thank you very much. Happy pantoing.
This is our first day here, and we've just all met properly, so...
Yeah. I can see you in your Prince Charming costume, George.
This is just as normal.
Oh, yeah, I'm not in my... Yeah.
You didn't get that in Union J, did you?
It kind of matches your tie. Giving us panto.
I'm keeping the vibe alive with the colour scheme. Yeah. I like to come prepared. All right, so, Samantha, you're playing the fairy godmother in this Cinderella. Is there any kind of inspiration you're thinking might influence you in interpreting the character?
Absolutely not. I'm a terrible fairy godmother
because
I'm naughty and I'm cheeky. So I have to remember, because sometimes I play baddies. And so
you were the White Witch in Lion Witch and the Wardrobe.
I was.
And
I was
Gillian Lynn, weren't you?
Yeah, and I was a good baddie. But actually, I'm now... I'm now responsible for bringing some magic, I think, to the show. So I need to remember not to be cheeky.
Well, I suppose you can be cheeky to an extent.
As long as you still bring the magic, I think.
Yeah, I don't know what pantos you've been seeing, but the few I've seen, and
you
the one I was in.
Fairies.
Well, yeah, I suppose not the fairies. It's usually sisters or buttons.
Because I feel like it's that responsibility of like when the kids, especially for the six to ten, they kind of invest in the fairy godmother.
We had Bobby Davro as buttons,
and he was obviously the fairy godmother.
Yeah, they need to like respect the fairy.
Funny you mention him. Yeah. I was actually having to be in the audience when you were on the chase with him.
Oh, you were? Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah. That was bad. That talk about embarrassing.
Well, I got the chase.
Every question wrong.
Oh, my goodness. I did House of Cards, you know, Richard Orson.
Yeah.
And General Knowledge, I was great. But then all of a sudden they flipped the answers into anagrams. I was like, well, now my brain is scrambled. You come last on the leaderboard. It's so embarrassing.
George, is this your first time doing panto?
Second. Yeah, and this is the second Cinderella I've done.
Prince Charming?
In Dartford last year with Bobby. He was buttons, and it was really good. I loved it. I was really nervous about it to begin with, and I'd never seen a panto before.
No way.
Yeah, my boyfriend literally took me to see one in Hereford.
That was your first one. That's insane.
Yeah, I don't know why. It was just never really like something we went to as kids.
Well, I think the lovely thing about panto is it can probably be the start of. I know what it's like to go to a show and have it change your life.
Mm.
And
panto
could also be the start of that.
Like,
there could be people coming to your show that have never been to the theatre before.
I love that.
And they fall in love with it.
Yeah. I think that's so important, isn't it?
Special. A lot of responsibility for us then. Especially you, Carrie Godmother.
It kind of gives you both and all the cast the responsibility as to what and a reminder as to why what you do is special.
Yeah. I love that.
Mm.
But then you're talking to someone who's seen Julian Clary five times at the London Palladium.
Oh, they're fantastic as well.
Families are going to come and watch this show. I'm interested to know, what are your memories of seeing panto when you were younger?
I remember my first show that I saw when I was little was Barnum with Michael Crawford at the Palladium. And I just remember being, exactly as you said, I was blown away. I was in tears. I played the album over and over again for about 2 years. And then I found out years later, when I did Who Do You Think You Are, that my great-great-great-grandmother actually was in Barnum Circus.
Oh, my God.
And I wondered whether that was part of the reason that I responded to it in the way. So she travelled with Tom Thumb. We read all of the Barnum's diaries that she
was
in. Yeah, it was incredible. But that was my first show, and I was just blown away by
it. It's like in your body. It's in your bones, in your DNA.
In your
blood. Whoa.
Ian McKellen used to say, like, once you caught the stage bug, you've got it.
You've got it for life.
Yeah.
So with pantos, they are expected to be some pop songs. Don't want to say shoehorn, but they're kind of woven in there. George, having been in a pop band, I suppose those bits just come naturally to you.
We did in last Cinderella, but not this time. No, I think it's been too long, and they weren't really that. Oh no!
I'm gonna see if I can get one of your songs in. Just do a little.
Well, Jamie does a lot of shows for you guys as well. My other bandmate, and he's got an incredible voice. And when you're in a band, you're supported by like other people singing the song. So this was one of the first times I really like sang a whole song beginning to end on my own on stage.
Because you're normally supported,
so. And I'm baritone as well, so I'm usually like on harmonies and verses, so when it comes to choruses I either can't reach them and need to bring them down. So I'm like embracing the lowest parts of my voice at the moment and my tone. So yeah, it's just finding the right song. And yeah, as much as I was in a boy band, I can't really dance very well either. So if you want a good laugh at Christmas,
I'm really excited to see your performance.
Yeah,
I think I am
a
as well.
Fairy and a Prince Charming
dance. I look forward to the wedding scene at the end.
That's what will make it special.
Oh no, the ball scene. Yeah, the ball scene. Yeah. So Cinderella is a classic fairy tale. What do you think makes audiences resonate with it so well?
I think the rags to riches thing is always in spite of everything that you might think is your life, to have kind of belief in magic.
It's a beautiful
thing to believe in.
I think that's a really nice place for us to end it. Unfortunately, time has beaten us, but thank you so much for your time today.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.